Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Dr. Snyder. We have Leanne Lewis, one of the members. We have Jennifer Guffey, who has a proxy for Roxanne Brown. Dr. Johnson is on, who has the proxies for Will Cromer and Mary Yarbrough. So we have five out of the six members so far. Hopefully Marcia will join us shortly. I think the first for since we do not have a co-chair or chair for this meeting, I would could I ask the members to appoint Leanne Lewis as the chair for this meeting?
That's fine with me.
Okay, Dr. Johnson, okay. And Jennifer Guffey, if you could unmute and consent.
Yes, that's fine with me. Can you hear me?
Okay. Yes, thank you. Leanne, I hope that's all right with you.
Sure, I'll do my best to get through everything.
Okay. I think you go ahead, then. Let's follow the agenda.
Okay, so the first thing we usually do is introductions from everybody who's on the meeting, correct? Should we just have everybody one by one unmute?
Let's run down. We have two, three, or four on the telephone. The first one is the 337-460 number. Could you introduce yourself, please?
I'm Jeannie Hoover with AmeriSafe.
Thank you. And the next one is 615-454 number. Unmute, please. The next one is 615-708. Unmute, please. Okay, let's go on. Diana Johnson.
Yes, I'm here.
Your organization, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Gallagher Bassett.
Okay. Anna?
Hi, from Corvell Corporation.
Okay. Gretchen Jackson?
I'm physical therapist, Association of Tennessee.
Okay. Christine Heine?
Hi, I'm from AF Group.
Kimberly Sprouse?
Good afternoon, from Gallagher Bassett.
Natalie Knox.
Hello, Natalie Knox from EnableComp.
And Suzanne Curley.
Hi, Susan Curley from OneCall.
Good. Thank you. Everybody else, I think, has been identified, I think, by Susie and Suzanne. Okay. Two other introductions I'd like to make since our last meeting. We have a new administrator. Troy Haley has been appointed administrator after the retirement of Abby Hudgens. And so I'd like to welcome Troy as our new administrator. He's well known to you as he has previously been our legislative liaison and legal counsel.
Absolutely. Good to see everybody again. And so far, so good. No major catastrophes in the first 6 weeks or so of sitting in Abby's chair. And very pleased to hopefully continue the good work that she did for so many years.
And our new legislative liaison and legal counsel is Amanda Terry. She had previously been with the Bureau in the Compliance Program. And so welcome to Amanda.
Thank you all for having me. Excited to be part of the group and continue the work that Troy Haley's done. That's been so great. So.
Okay, Leanne, next.
The next thing on the agenda, I see... We already established we have a quorum, so we should be good there. And then all members of the committee who are on, have you read the minutes? Do you have any questions about last meeting's minutes from July 19th? No? Okay, then would somebody like to make a motion to accept the meeting minutes from July 19th?
I'll move to accept the minutes.
And a second?
I second.
Okay. So moved. Then there's a note about conflict of interest forms. I think Susie has sent those out a while ago. Is there anybody that still needs to, do we have people who still need to turn them in, Susie?
No, we have them all. Thank you for asking, Leanne. We are in good shape for this fiscal year. Thank you.
Okay, great. And next, it looks like we can move on to case review with Dr. Snyder.
Okay, here we go. Case 58 is Parkridge Enable Comp versus Sedgwick. It was an underpayment for outpatient surgery. Anna, do you want to review this one?
Yes. So this was an outpatient bill for a revision of a total hip arthroplasty. The facility is requesting payment for the surgical procedure and the preceding emergency room visit. Revision of a total hip arthroplasty is billed under CPT 27486. That falls under APC 5115, which has a status indicator of J1. So that means that all associated services, including the emergency department visit, are going to be bundled into that APC payment. The fee schedule amount for APC 5115 is $18,472.14. So that leaves an additional payment due in the amount of $9,015.37, less any contractual allowances.
Any questions?
Not for me.
Okay. Get a motion, please.
Yep. Would anybody like to make a motion to accept the recommendation?
I'll move.
And a second. I'm not sure if I can. I will do so if I can. Okay, I'll make a second for that.
We'll have to resort to Robert's Rules of Order on that one, but okay. Since we have such few members, I think we're going to have to accept it.
Okay.
Okay. Case 59. This was Dr. Hazelwood versus Gallagher. They downcoded a follow-up office visit. It was billed at $221. They paid $64.99. The expectation was $154.93. In this particular case, the history reviewed was the previous treatment in a number of systems, the current medications. There was a limited exam for the low back, but there was a gait, there was a neurologic examination, gait of the lower extremities. However, the assessment and the plan were extensive, and so I think that this particular case fit with level 4, 992214, rather than the 99213. And I recommend an additional payment due of $89.94, less any contractual discounts.
Are there any questions from the group about the recommendation? No, then would somebody like to make a motion to accept the recommendation?
I move to accept.
And a second?
I second that motion.
So moved.
Okay. Case 60 was resolved. I think you guys are going to like a number of these. 60 was resolved. Case 61 was Dr. Hazelwood versus Gallagher was downcoded office visit, a follow-up visit. They billed $231. They paid $70.29. They expected $163.54. In this case, there was an extensive review of the history and prior treatment. but the in-office exam was limited by COVID, and there was a very limited discussion. And so I think it fit with the downcoding of 99213, and in this case, there was no additional payment due.
Any questions on that one from the group? Then we're looking for would somebody like to recommend that we accept that there's no additional?
I move to accept.
And a second? I'll second it if nobody else is available to do that.
I second that motion.
Okay, and so moved.
Yeah. Sometimes you have to hit the unmute button and you can't find it. Okay, case 62 was closed. Case 63 was resolved. Case 64 was closed. Case 65, at present it was St. Francis Hospital versus National Casualty in Mitchell. Incomplete information was received from St. Francis Hospital and no reduction, no redacted version, and so we are awaiting further information on that claim. Case 66 was closed. Case 67 was withdrawn. It was less than a $10 difference. Case 68 was closed because it was a Kentucky claim. Case 69 was from St. Francis Hospital also, and that redaction was incomplete, and we're waiting for further information. Case 70. This was the dispute between Neurosurgical and Gallagher Bassett over a PPO discount for a records review. $220 was billed, $165.30 was paid, $200 were expected. This analysis had a signed contract and is also included on our rules. And so no PPO discount was applicable on this one, and the recommendation is that this is a full amount is due.
Any questions from the group on that one? Okay, if not, do we have a motion to accept the recommendation?
I move to accept.
And a second?
I second the motion.
So moved.
Case 71. This is Chattanooga Orthopedics versus Employers Insurance. This is a follow-up on the previous cases from the last meeting. You'll recall there was an injury to a patient that included the wrist and the elbow. The insurance company paid for the durable medical equipment for the wrist, and they also paid for the x-rays for both the wrist and the elbow, but they did not pay for the office visit. This was a follow-up on that one. At the same time that the wrist splint was given, there was another bill for an elbow splint, and this was billed. And interestingly enough, we got a notification from the defense attorney that they're trying to resolve all of these payments. So there's no action necessary from the committee. And then finally, case 72 is Chattanooga Orthopedics versus AmeriSafe. This was a payment for surgery that was appealed to us for an underpayment. $7,800 was billed, paid $3,144.71. Expected was $3,545.03. And Anna, you have a report on this one?
Yes. So the provider on this one is billing for an arthroscopic rotator cuff repair, an extensive shoulder debridement, and a subacromial decompression. The provider was paid for all codes, but they're disputing the payment amount for the 29823. because it was not paid at 275% of the Tennessee Medicare amount for a board-certified orthopedic surgeon. However, after reviewing the operative report, it was found that extensive debridement, as described in the definition of 29823, is not supported, and no payment should have been made initially for that code. Per the definition, 29823 requires debridement of three distinct structures, and per CPT CIS December 2020, those structures can't be a part of any other procedure that was performed. So since the criteria was not met for 29823 and should not have been paid on the initial submission, no additional payment is recommended to the provider.
Any questions from the group on that one? Okay, then is there a motion to accept the recommendation of no additional due?
I move to accept.
And a second?
I second the motion.
I think that was the last one.
Yay, I commend the committee for all of their work on getting through that. Just to let you know, the statistics we keep on the Medical Payment Committee, I think we all have to thank Susie for the work that she does. So there, during the last quarter, that is the quarter of July through September, there were 23 submissions to the Medical Payment Committee. Of those, 11 of them were administratively closed due to the work that Susie did and also with help from Suzanne. And so of that, then, there were only 16 decisions in the last quarter that had to go to the committee. So Susie's work reduces the committee's workload significantly, and I want to make sure that everybody understands that. So thank you, Susie.
Yeah, I definitely am grateful for anything that will make a meeting shorter. So thank you, Suzanne and Susie. It looks like the next item on the agenda is the Reward and Certified Physician Program. Is that you, Dr. Snyder?
That is going to be delayed until the next meeting since Mary Yarborough was the one that requested that, and unfortunately she's not with us, so we thought that we would delay that until the next meeting in December.
Okay.
But we are going to go through a little bit, just a quick outline. And then we'll probably have more extensive discussion on it later, but I wanted to go through the next part, which is just a brief overview of the Bureau's programs. So I'm going to try to share my screen.
I can see it.
Okay. So I wanted to kind of let those that are interested and those on the committee know a little bit about what the Bureau programs are. So we're going to start with the administrative programs. The administrative part of the programs keeps track of all the first reports of injuries that are filed, all the forms that include denial of benefits, payment of benefits, and other required forms to keep track of all the claims activities. This is obviously with nearly 100,000 claims per year that are filed with the Bureau, then that's quite a big job. The next program is proof of coverage services. So questions from anybody about coverage that a company has can be verified through the Bureau. And Amanda and Troy and anybody else from the Bureau, if they want to chime in on these, please do so. The third program is legislative services, which include the evaluation of new rules, but also all of the contacts with the state legislature, as well as the governor's office. This includes the filing of changes to the rules, new rules, legislative filings, and all inquiries from the legislators and from the governor's office and other administrative agencies.
Yeah, that's a big job. That's a big job that Amanda Terry is now going to be the point person on. Legislatively, there's not been a whole lot of activity lately. Rulemaking, though, we've got a huge rulemaking task ahead of us. It came about due to some legislation from last year that will require all of the state departments and agencies to review each and every one of their rules one by one to see if those rules should be either amended, repealed, or kept as is. So Amanda's going to be the point person on that project, and that's going to keep us all fairly busy for the next several months. We've got until December the 1st to finish that project, December the 1st of 2023, but we have to be one-third of the way through with that project by January 1. So it's going to take some time, but we will get through it.
And the other part of Amanda's job is the penalty program that receives referrals from other administrative agent, other programs within the Bureau, as well as the Workers' Compensation, Court of Workers' Compensation Claims. The next program area is called MOST, which is the Mediation and Ombudsman Services of Tennessee. This includes the Ombudsman Hotline, which is our advice and reception for all incoming questions from attorneys, from injured workers, from other parties, to get information and to coordinate communications. The next part then is the mediation services. So anytime a petition for benefits determination, that is a request for over a dispute, goes to the mediation services. These individuals then contact both parties and try to arrange an adequate settlement before it's filed with the Court of Workers' Compensation Claims. And then finally, the ombudsman attorneys. These individuals can give limited advice to individuals that have filed a dispute with the Bureau. And these attorneys then can help an unrepresented employee, unrepresented injured worker, to obtain documents and to file the necessary information to further their claim with the mediation or with the Court of Workers' Compensation Claims. These attorneys at this time, they cannot actually represent an employee, but they can give some limited legal advice, but do a lot of information concerning information gathering and the documents necessary for an individual to support their claims.
Yeah, just a quick note on that. One of our ombudsman attorneys that we have in Tennessee, we have two currently. We sent one of them to Texas to basically shadow and look at the ombudsman program in Texas. And they have a very unusual ombudsman program there where there was a carve out in their Reform Act 15 years or so ago that lets injured workers basically be represented in mediations and in court hearings by a non-attorney ombudsman. And Texas seems to be the only state that has that sort of carve-out system. But we'd like to see our program expand because in Tennessee currently there's only about 50% roughly of the injured workers who have any sort of legal representation, and the other half basically do it themselves. It's a bit of a, you know, a complicated process because of formal court rules and civil procedure rules, evidence rules, and we'd like to help however we can. The interesting thing that I learned the other day about the Texas system versus the Tennessee system is we have a pretty good success ratio in our mediation program. Almost 80% of the disputes are resolved by our mediators in Tennessee, whereas in Texas it's the exact opposite. They only resolve about 20% of their disputes in the mediation process, and we're not exactly sure why, but there seems to be very little cooperation in Texas with the mediator in the mediation process. So we've got some good things going here, and we'd like to continue the good work that's been done by expanding that ombudsman attorney program if we can. But of course, that's all subject to funding from the legislature.
The next program area is the compliance program. It includes two particular funds. The first one, an uninsured employer fund. So if an uninsured employer suffers an employee from an uninsured employer suffers an injury, they can apply to the uninsured employers fund. Unfortunately, the limits on the employee's recovery for this is $20,000 in medical expenses and $20,000 in indemnity benefits as a maximum. And so at the present time, one of the, I think one of our goals is to increase those maximum to help those injured workers that are injured on the job by an uninsured employer.
Yeah, for sure. We wish that we didn't have to have an uninsured employer program. That would mean that employers were all doing the right thing and following the law by providing work comp coverage for their employees. But unfortunately, I don't think that'll ever happen. So the $20,000 cap on temp benefits, lost wages, and $20,000 on the medical is not much. It helps, but that money is funded by the penalties that we assess against uninsured employers and those who misclassify their employees as independent contractors. We'd like to increase those, maybe offer a death benefit. There's currently no death benefit, and there's no permanent partial disability benefit available, so we'd like to see that done as well. But that's all contingent on legislative approval and on us being able to collect those penalties that we assess against those non-compliant employers.
And then the next one is the employer. I think I misspelled this one. The Employer Misclassification Education and Enforcement Fund. And so employers can kind of cheat on their funding of their benefits through the insurer, the amount that they pay in their premiums, by misclassifying employees, either independent contractors or by understating their payroll, which is the basis on which they pay their premiums. So those are two things. The misclassification fund identifies those and then enforces those limits by penalties. So, Amanda, do you have any extra thing to add to that since these were your programs?
No, I think you did a great job covering it. It's just, as you and Troy both mentioned, you know, with the Uninsured Employers Benefit Fund, part of the issue there is not necessarily the assessments, but being able to collect on the assessments. So hopefully we can continue to do that and make improvements and keep that fund going.
And Claudia Byers, an attorney with the Bureau for many years, has taken Amanda's former position as of September 1, and Claudia has already hit the ground running and is going to do a great job.
We have a number of ancillary programs that are run by the Bureau, including the Drug-Free Workplace Program. This is a program that gives education and information to employers that are interested in maintaining drug-free workplaces. And so those can be applied, and it's a discount on their premiums for that program, as well as information and educational programs for the employees that are involved. The next one is the Subsequent Injury Fund. This is a separate fund that's used for injured workers who have had previous settlement from previous workers' compensation claims. And so this fund is designed to help offset the employer's cost of a subsequent injury. And so this is a that fund and the attorneys that work for that then assess and litigate and try to settle claims that involved previous injuries. And then finally, in this section is the Next Step program, which is the Bureau's scholarship program to assist injured workers who cannot go back to their previous occupation and are seeking new training. So whether it be college or whether it be trade school or other new employment can seek scholarship money from this fund. It's capped at a maximum of $5,000 per year for 4 years, but would also piggybacks with other available resources for individuals who qualify for other educational benefits in the state. The medical program includes the evaluation and management of the fee schedule, the functions of utilization review appeals, case management, and the medical impairment rating registry. Just to give you some idea, the Lacey Connor keeps track of 1,321 case managers and case managers assistants that are active in the state of Tennessee. And these include both telephonic case managers as well as field case managers, and include their registration, their educational requirements, and their continuing education requirements. So that's quite a big job. The Medical Impairment Rating Registry then is the dispute, the administrative dispute resolution mechanism for impairment ratings where there is a dispute about those ratings. And this can be applied through the Bureau. And then finally, the adjudication function. Bureau has two courts. One is the Court of Workers' Compensation Claims, which is the administrative court that is the appeal mechanism for the Bureau for disputes. And then a second level of appeals can be forwarded to the Workers' Compensation Appeals Board prior to the final dispute resolution, which would go to the Supreme Court. Both of these courts have been very effective in reducing the length of time that an injured worker does not have resolution of their claims. And also it provides, the appeals board provides a very quick resolution to appeals, and very few then of those resolutions actually go before the Supreme Court. So they've been very effective in doing what they're supposed to do, which is to administer a consistent system and do so in a very timely manner. Two other programs, obviously, we do have customers, and those customers include the injured workers, their employers and insurers, other employees of other agencies, as well as our own attorneys and providers. So all of those are part of our program and our customer service. And then finally, our education programs include a physician education conference that's held annually, the annual education conference, which is now in its 26th year. And then finally, our website, which includes all the information that has available both for injured workers and for the other programs within the Bureau. So that is it on that. And so I will stop sharing.
Thanks so much. That's some good information. Does anyone on the phone have any questions about any of that? Anything you need more information on?
I hope that was useful, just to give you some idea of what we do every day.
Oh, yeah, I think that was very, very helpful to know all the different things the Bureau is involved in, for sure. Helped me a lot.
I was just going to just jump in and say I don't do social media, but we are fairly active in the social media world too, with Twitter and Facebook and such. So if you all are into that, feel free to check us out.
Good to know. Thanks. It looks like we've got a COVID update on here next. And Dr. Snyder, I think that's usually you do that, right?
Yes. As of the end of August, there were 14,545 claims filed with the Bureau with the codes that matched for COVID or vaccine-related claims. Of those, initially, 8,500 were denied, and presently initial payments have been made in 1,600. So there's still some outstanding 2,000 claims which have not been been fully satisfied yet as of the end of August. We do have 51 fatalities that have been reported to the Bureau, of which 36 of those have been denied as related to work-related injury. 12 of them have been accepted for death claims that were work-related, and then one remains outstanding at the present time. There's been very little change in this these numbers over the course of the last probably 6 weeks or so. So it's pretty static.
Okay, any questions from the group on that topic? No? Okay, so next I see the medical fee schedule is on here.
Okay, here we go. Okay, so at the last meeting I requested any, comments on the medical fee schedule. I didn't receive any from the meeting, but to let you know that the public hearing for the medical fee schedule changes is to be November the 8th at 1 p.m. here in our offices. Now, at that time, we will take both oral and written comments, but the Bureau will not make any comments. And from November the 8th for the following 2 weeks, then written comments will be accepted by the Bureau. So make a note on your calendar if you have comments that you want to make. Now, as it has to do with the medical fee schedules, both chapters 17, 18, and 19 have been posted on the Secretary of State's website. They are not always easy to find, so I just wanted to kind of run down how you can get to it. And if you have any questions, you can email either Susie or I, and we can send you the link. But if you go on the Secretary of State's website and then go under publications and then under rules and regulations, then you will come on the right side. It will say rulemaking hearings. So this is where you want to go. And on page two, then all of the medical fee schedules can be viewed. So that's on the Secretary of State's website. If you have any problems getting there, just contact either Susie or I. as it has to do with the medical fee schedule, the changes that we've made. So I'm going to give you some ideas as to the changes that we have made, just to run down. The first thing is FairHealth is going to create or has created rate tables for us. These rate tables means that you will not have to calculate, either the payers or the providers will not have to calculate their own fees, that they will be listed in the rate tables. And these will include gap fill codes, in other words, those codes that have not been priced by Medicare. This will eliminate the need for the interpretation and calculations and reduce the number of informational requests that come to the Bureau. And it also should reduce the disputes being sent to the Medical Payment Committee. These rate tables will be free to individuals and to companies that request them through FairHealth. Now, remember, this is only after we get these rules approved. So this is all stuff that's forward through 2023. So don't request anything from FairHealth for Tennessee for a while yet. So there has been some other updates, particularly the current terminology to be used for anesthesia services. Then there is an addition of a modifier that will alert payers to the additional reimbursements that will be due certified occupational medicine and physical medicine and rehabilitation physicians. This was not included in the last revision to the medical fee schedule. And so the addition of that modifier will alert the payers that these physicians are board certified. We have also increased the rates to try to attract more subspecialty physicians to treat injured workers. This includes pulmonology, psychiatry, cardiology, neurology, and clinical psychologists. There has been significant confusion over the use of certain payment codes that have been eliminated by from the CPT book, or that we use CPT codes under special circumstances. These are going to be replaced by state-specific Z codes, and these payment codes would then have set prices for these CPT codes that have been confusing. The best example is that for missed appointments. So we had used an XXX99 code for missed appointments, and so that's created a lot of confusion since it's not according to the CPT book. As a result, then, we have produced a Z code for a missed appointment for both the initial visit and follow-up visits, and that these will have set prices to them. We have reduced the payments for certain laboratory procedures that to bring it in line with national and regional values, as these have been overpriced. And then finally, we have received from NCCI that the changes that we are suggesting have a negligible impact on the compensation costs for employers, and hopefully this will attract some of those hard to find specialists. So that's where we are on the fee schedule. Any questions?
I read through all the documents yesterday, and I didn't have any questions on what was there.
Okay, great. We will be receiving written comments as well as verbal comments at the meeting. And so if you have any further comments or anything that you see after you look through them, please let me know.
Great. Thank you so much. Okay, so the next item on the agenda is just new business, appointment of a co-chair is on here.
I think could we delay that until the next meeting since...
when we have everybody here.
Yeah. Since we've got so few people here.
Sure. Do you want to wait until the next meeting to pick our February meeting as well, since we're missing a few and have proxies?
Well, I think we can probably set it if the people here have any objection. I think we'd have to change the date anyhow. So
okay.
So February 7th or 14th, is there any conflict with either, with anybody on that?
I would prefer the 14th. I think I'm going to have something on the 7th.
Okay. Any other objections to the 14th?
14th is fine for me.
Okay. That's the date. So Valentine's Day, but hopefully it won't interrupt any evening plans.
Yeah, I hope not. Okay, so I do not, unfortunately, don't remember how we officially close this out. I don't know what the words are I'm supposed to say. I'm sorry.
Just say, hearing no further objection, we adjourn.
Okay. Hearing no further objection, we adjourn the meeting.
Thank you, everybody. Everyone. Appreciate everything that you do.